This is episode 469 of Wheel Bearings. I am Sam Abuel from Telemetry.
And I'm Roberto Balder from SAE International, and I'm a child.
Well, you know, if you can't act like a child once in a while.
No, this is all the time. What's the point? To be honest, this is I live like a 17-year-old.
It could be worse.
I don't have kids. I live like I'm still in college. I'm like,
oh, duh, duh. But I mean, you have
just bumbling through life like an idiot.
You have animals, and you know, you have a wife, and they're all surviving.
Yeah.
So
yeah, but my wife is also all bad. We're both art school people, so
there you go.
there's the rub. It's all art school stuff all the time.
All right. Well, what have you been driving this week?
So this week I drove the Honda Prelude, the car that angered the internet. So I remember Honda announces it. They tell you what it is. Everyone loses their minds. They look at the specs. They're like, why isn't this, you know, a BRZ? Well, first of all, the Prelude was never that. It was always sporty. It was never a sports car. So there's that. Having driven it, this is okay, so I have my BRZ. Now, to me, the Prelude is like a grown-up's BRZ. It's more comfortable. It gets incredibly, you know, it's incredibly efficient. Uh-huh. I was getting like 42, 43 miles per gallon driving around in a Prelude. I drove it to Monterey and back. I went to the IndyCar race this past weekend. My back didn't hurt. Like I had a nice, it was nice to drive. Like that Hummer after like 45 minutes, I was just like, oh, my back, no problems in the Prelude. It was a nice experience. You put in GT mode, you put in comfort mode, nice, you know, cruising down the freeway, getting really great gas mileage, drove all the way to Monterey and back, drove it around before I had to get gas. Just a really nice, like drive, like just regular day-to-day driving experience. So then yesterday I wasn't feeling well. So I didn't get to take it up into the mountains to do all twisties, but I got to do that today, right before this podcast. And that Type R, you know, they just threw the Type R like suspension and tuning and chassis and all that fun stuff. They just threw it on the Prelude, and it's fantastic. It corners so well. It's still front wheel drive. You still feel the pull instead of the push. But
you can also trail brake it into corners.
Yes, and so but it is very wizardry, magic, sacrifice. I don't know what they did at Honda. And I remember with the Type R like 8 years ago or whatever, when the Type R came out, they're like, yeah, we virtually eliminated oversteer. I'm like, yeah, whatever. And then I got that car and I tried to oversteer it so much. Like, you really had to do some crazy stuff to get that thing to oversteer. It's the same thing with this. Like, things where I thought I was going to notice some oversteer. Nope. It is such a well-engineered vehicle. It is such a grown-up, like, enthusiast car. So this is a car. Now, it's not a Miata. It's not rear-wheel drive. It's not a BRZ or a GR. You know, it's not any of those cars. It's not an S2000. It's none of that. It's front-wheel drive. It does not have a manual transmission. That's the biggest hit to this vehicle, is the fact that it does not have a manual transmission, and Honda makes an amazing manual transmission. That's the worst part. If it didn't have a manual transmission and like the automaker was just bad at making manual transmissions, you'd be like, well, it doesn't have it. It'd be nice, but whatever. Honda makes an amazing manual transmission, and it's not in this car. Instead, they have this S Plus, which is like Sport Plus, Super Plus. I don't know what it stands for. But you use the paddle shifters, and it recreates the driving a manual transmission, sort of. Like, you can hear
it's
the
kind of, it's kind of like what Hyundai does on the Ioniq 5N.
Yeah, it's like it's a hybrid version of the Ioniq 5N. It's very fun. It's a lot more fun than just drive. I took it out. I drove it up, used the S Plus. I took it out of it, did it. It was more fun with the fake, you know, sort of shifting bits. It's got two hybrid motors. It's got a gas. It is an engineering marvel. It is very comfortable, but it is what enthusiasts graduate to, I think, when you just, when your spine and your kidneys and your body, you just can't like just fall into a car anymore. You can't handle the constant, you know, you have to, you know, you need a car. Maybe it's your second car, but it's the car you drive every day. Then you have to go to work and you got to sit in traffic and your left knee's sort of starting to give you some problems. And maybe your ankle's sort of like tired of dealing with the clutch. And you're just like, ah, every clamp, 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 blah, 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 blah. It is, you're like, you know what? Maybe I should sell the BRZ and get a Prelude. Maybe I should sell the Miata and get a Prelude. Maybe I should, it's, and I don't want to say this is the people who give up. I think this is the people who just like, okay, here's the reality of the situation. the way I drive this vehicle or how I drive this vehicle is not that of a 20-year-old enthusiast. I drive this as an adult and I just need to get around, but I still want a really fun car to drive. It's very fun when you can get it. You know, you can still take it on the back roads. It's still, you know, it's, you could toss it around. I was very impressed with how well it handled. It is not a fast car. I think it does 0 to 60 in 6 something. It's slower than the BRZ.
It's quick enough.
It's quick enough. It's a what do you call it? A momentum car.
Like yes.
You just keep moving. And again, my only issue with it is it doesn't have a clutch. You know, it doesn't have that third pedal. But and that is because Honda makes an amazing transmission that they're slowly taking out of cars because people do not buy manual transmissions. So this is a very, they know they're not going to sell a lot of these. I don't know if the decision to not put a manual transmission was a good idea or not. I think there was probably some complexities when it came to the hybrid system, blah, blah, blah. There's all these things you can sit there and justify for not having it in there. I've always said that every Prelude is a good Prelude, like first generation. Yeah, every generation Prelude has had is like what it's good at it's a fun car. It's never been, you know, it's never been the Supra. It's never been, you know, the Miata, like I said, it's never been a sports car. It's not, you know, they had the S2000. We had that for a while. Now it's gone. Let's all keep crying about that. but it's like a Type R for, like, it's an adult Type R. There we go. That's what I think it is. It's an adult Type R, or, you know, you're graduating up. Or you just don't want to drive a manual transmission, which I understand. Some people just think, don't know how, which yeah. I understand. If your parents never taught you how to drive manual transmission and they've been giving you guff about it, you know, that's their fault, to be honest.
Yeah. I mean, I commuted daily to jobs for 30 years in cars with manual transmissions. And, you know, and a fair amount of that driving was, you know, in stop and go traffic. So, you know, I'm 60 years old now. So I understand, you know, why, you know, if you need something as a daily driver, you might not want that to be a car with a manual transmission after you've been doing it for a long time.
Yeah.
Yeah. If it was me, I wouldn't mind having a Prelude in the garage and also having my Miata that I take out. My Miata is my toy. You know, yeah. I take it out once or twice a week, you know, go out, bomb around for a while. You know, I took it out on Sunday, drove around for about 2.5 hours, you know, going nowhere in particular. And then, you know, stopped off on the way home at a farm market and bought, you know, half a dozen ears of corn and some
cider donuts.
You
couldn't buy more than that, to be honest, because it wouldn't fit in a little trunk. But, you know, I filled the trunk with my Miata with a half a dozen donuts and some corn.
No, I mean, I could easily get a couple dozen ears of corn.
There you go. 4 dozen ears
of corn. And since I was driving by myself, I could also use the passenger seat.
Passenger seat. That's extra, yeah. People never think about that.
Yeah.
They're like, how are you going to get your guitar to the space? I'm like, no one's in the car with me. I just put it in the passenger seat. Ta-da.
I do that with my paddle board sometimes, you know, and have the oar, you know, the paddle and the board, you know, sitting in there. No problem at all.
I put an 8-foot-long 2x2s. Into my BRZ, and I drove them home from the hardware store. I just had to go all the way from the back, all the way out the side, so they were like snug in between the passenger side mirror thing. I stuck like a little towel.
I did that. I haven't done that with the Miata, but I did that with the Mustang.
Yeah, so it was like I was jousting on the way home.
Exactly. Yeah. fold down the back seat, you know, so stick it back all the way back into the trunk, you know, and have, you know, a few feet sticking out the window. No problem.
Civic hybrid is way to go. Still more fun and way more practical. Yeah, see, the thing is I don't care about practicality because I don't have other people with me.
You know, if
Adam, I bet Adam makes it so Adam says in the chat, the Prelude is great, but 50 ponies shy of enough power, which I think it's 400 pounds too heavy. I would like it to have had a little bit more power. Sometimes on the freeway, I felt like I didn't get I didn't have the oomph that I wanted in order to pass. And then I feel like most people, the Civic hybrid is the way to go, still fun and way more practical. I still think but that Type R suspension makes it a lot more fun.
Yeah.
This is for people. If you live somewhere where you have...
The key difference is the suspension and the brakes on the Prelude.
Yeah, the suspension and brakes are outstanding. The power is... it's fine.
I mean, I totally agree with Adam that, you know, the Civic Hybrid is fantastic. You know, and, you know, if you've got, you know, one or two young kids that, you know, still car seats, you know, or even if they're not in car seats, you know, booster seats, whatever, you know, that you also need to shuttle around, yeah, absolutely go for the Civic Hybrid.
Yeah.
But, you know, if you don't have to carry anybody but your partner around, then go for the Prelude. It's great.
It is a great second car. How's that? Mm-hmm. I think that's the Civic Hybrid and the Prelude, or, you know, the Ridgeline and the Prelude, or I guess most people would just get the CRV, which is why we don't have the Fit anymore.
Yeah, exactly.
The CRV, which I pour one out for the Honda Fit.
And the thing is, you know, because the Prelude already has Type R suspension, Type R brakes on it, my guess is that come November, when SEMA rolls around, I would be shocked. And you can go to Honda. They sell Type R crate engines. You can buy a Type R engine, transmission, the electronics, and it'll drop right in there. And I would be shocked if there isn't somebody at SEMA this year that has a Prelude with a Type R powertrain in it, with a six-speed manual and everything.
Yeah, I could see that. I mean, Hondas are so easy to work on. They're so easy to do engine swaps. There's a reason why the Civic and, you know, was you know, people were just throwing gigantic engines, you know, Ks and K engines into the Civic because it was just easy. Like, you could just, like, me and my friends could swap an engine, like, you know, in the course of a day because we were goofing around most of the time.
Yeah, and, you know, they're not, you know, they're aluminum, so they're not that heavy. I mean, you know, all you need is some chains and a, you know, a 4x4, you know, to if you don't have a an engine
cherry picker.
What's the engine thing we
called them cherry pickers when I was a kid. There's a real name, engine lifter thing.
Yeah.
But you can get those from Harbor Freight for, like, you know, not very much money, and it's because it's a Honda.
Yeah,
it's
but
very
you know
light.
What I think I would be more trusting of a couple of friends of mine lifting the engine out than using a Harbor Freight crane.
I bought a Harbor Freight crane for when we had to swap the engine on my Civic or on my Del Sol. One of them had it. Both of them ended up, the Del Sol needed a new engine. The engine blew. And I bought one. It was like $100. And then when I was done, I just left it at the person's house. I'm like, Merry Christmas. And I just wandered off. I just wandered away. I did go back and take the engine because the engine was still there like a month later. And I went and took the engine and I disposed of it at some place. And it takes engines. I don't know. I guess a junkyard. I don't know. It was a very long time ago. Here's the deal. Is the Prelude is a pricey car. It starts at $42,000. Woof. So that's where you're like, okay, what am I? You're paying for that type, all those Type R bits thrown on there.
Right.
That's what you're paying for.
At $42,000, it is roughly about halfway between the price of a Type R and a Civic Hybrid Sport Touring. So, you know, the Civic Hybrid Sport Touring, it's about $36,000-$37,000. $42,000 for the Prelude, you know, so you get the hybrid powertrain, but you get the Type R suspension and brakes, and that body design. And then, you know, if you want to go all the way, you know, if they sold a Prelude Type R, you know, it's going to be closer to $50,000 than $40,000 anyway.
Yeah.
So, because, yeah, you know, at 42, you know, you're right. It's not cheap, but it's not. It's not a horrible deal.
It's like a Goldilocks, and you're getting again, you're getting a Honda. At the end of the day, when you know, Honda has, you know, they have this reputation for reliability and great engineering, and they continue to say, yeah, well, you know, you get in the car, you close the door, you're like, yep, I'm in a Honda. As soon as you close that door, you get to, you're like, yeah, yeah.
Just fold down that vestigial back seat, and you got a big cargo area back there.
Seat, it's as useful as the BRZ seat. It's completely worthless.
At least you look at the seat on a BRZ, and it's usually got a little nicer upholstery on it than the back seat in the Prelude. You know, clearly they looked at it and they said, why are we spending a lot of money on upholstery for this? People are just going to fold it down and use it for cargo space. So just put the cheap stuff on there.
Yeah, the back seat is just like, what is it? It's to keep stuff from sliding from the trunk into the front. Yeah. That's what it's for. It's to keep stuff from hitting you in the back of the head in case of an accident. So it has a 2-liter 4-cylinder paddle shifters. It's a fun car. It's a lot more fun than I anticipated. It's a lot more comfortable than I anticipated. The comfort part was, you know, because it is still, you know, sports styled car. So, you know, you're sitting low, you know, you have the sports seats. I typically am more comfortable in sports seats than other seats. I don't know why. And the same was here. You know, I had seats are a completely unique individual thing. You get into the car, drive it around, really, you know, smush your body in there to see if you're going to be happy with those seats. The climate controls are knobs. I can turn hot, cold, you know, audio, hot, louder, quiet, like a lot of buttons. It does have, you know, it's infotainment system, which has along the side, it has like, you know, the hot has a, like a home button and a back button. And those are actual buttons. They're not like capacitive touch. Like they actually move you when you depress them, which is nice. Overall it has an electric e-brake, but also, you know, you have to do trail. So does
everything else today, though.
It's not a BRZ. That's what I'm trying to tell you. If you want a BRZ, definitely get a BRZ. If you want a Z, get a Z. If you want to be a little bit more comfortable, their EPA fuel economy is combined is 44, city is 46, highway is 41. It went into EV mode. Like whenever I was just cruising around, it was like in EV mode, which is really nice. It's nice and quiet and smooth. The transition from EV to gas was very smooth as well. And you don't have that, that you're getting with the Toyotas. It's a very composed, fun little car that you can toss around in the mountains and then drive to work and spend like, you know, however much it costs a gallon of gas for you. Here it's like, well, I think it's hitting six. It's almost $6. I paid $6.15 because I went on vacation last week and we were way, way, way up north in the middle of nowhere, and we paid $6.15 a gallon.
Don't use very many gallons when you're driving.
I wasn't driving that. We were driving a Chrysler Pacifica.
Oh, okay.
No, wait. We paid $5.95. We skipped the $6.15 a gallon, so we paid $5.95.
Got the cheap stuff, huh?
We got the cheap stuff, but and it came in the Boost Blue, which is beautiful.
Oh, that's a great color.
Yeah, I can understand. I understand why people were like boo, but not really. That's never what the Prelude was. I think it's like the Prelude has had the same issue that the NSX had. Like everyone thought, you know, the NSX came out. And it was so crazy to us as kids because it was a supercar from Japan. And like I remember like they had an ad about how even to save weight, they drilled holes in the brake, in the brake pedal. And we were like, that's crazy. Like it wasn't that crazy. But it was like to us, it was like amazing. And the new NSX comes out and they're like, well, it's not a this, it's not a that. It's not, you know, it doesn't have the throaty sound of another supercar. But also, like when I drove it, it had like 1,600 miles, which for a supercar, that might as well be 100,000 miles. And it drove great. And if anything broke, I could take it to an Acura dealer.
Yeah.
or a Honda dealer or whatever Honda adjacent dealer was nearby. Just, hey, can you fix my NSX? Yeah, okay, yeah, we can just order the parts. And meanwhile, so the story about the NSX real quick, we were shooting video of the NSX and these two guys rode by on like billion-dollar bicycles and they stopped and they came over and they're like, oh, this, am I guessing new NSX? Like, yeah, we both have Ferraris. My friends, his has been in Italy for 18 months. Mine, on the other hand, I need to get an oil change, but there's a 9-month wait. I was like, well, you could just get this and you would have saved money and you'd be able to drive it. They were like, wow, that's pretty cool. So that's the, yeah.
And you know what else? You can fit a stand-up roll-up, an inflatable stand-up paddleboard in the trunk of the NSX.
See, this is all the things you learn. This is why this is the most important podcast about cars, is our stand-up paddleboard, inflatable paddleboard content.
Yeah.
And random interactions with individuals who own Ferraris.
All right. So that's the prelude. I agree. I like the new prelude. I like it a lot.
Did you know you can support Wheel Bearings directly? Head to patreon.com/wheelbearingsmedia and you can become a patron today. Your contributions will help fund the platforms and tools we use to bring the podcast to you. And exclusives and improvements are already on the way thanks to your generosity. So if you want to be part of an automotive podcast like no other, head to patreon.com/wheelbearingsmedia.
We've updated the Wheel Bearings merch store, and now there's a whole bunch of new choices, new colors, new styles, t-shirts, sweatshirts, hoodies, hats, mugs, travel mugs, stickers, aprons, tote bags, you name it. You can get your Wheel Bearings merch at shop.wheelbearings.media. Go check it out. That's shop.wheelbearings.media.
So I had the 2026 Land Rover Discovery Gemini Edition. So this, you know, this is kind of the little brother to the Range Rovers. You know, it's not as fancy as a Range Rover. It's not as the current generation Discovery is not, you know, kind of the, not quite as hardcore an off-roader as the Defender or old school Discoveries were. But you know, it's a nice balance, you know, for a lot of people. If, you know, if you like Land Rovers, Land Rovers / Range Rovers, you want a little more room, a little more comfort than a Defender. You know, you don't necessarily need to go all the places that a Defender might be able to go. The currently comes only with a 3-liter inline six, mild hybrid, which has, 48 volt belted starter generator, and it's also got an electric supercharger on there. Very much like the configuration on the experimental Grand Cherokee that we saw a month or so ago at a Stellantis event. Where SRT is working on a system like this that a whole bunch of other automakers have already had in production for years. Mm-hmm. In the Discovery, this sole setup with an 8-speed automatic makes 355 horsepower, 369 pound-feet of torque. So not as powerful as like the Stellantis Hurricane 6-cylinder, even though it's the same size, but still more than adequate. It's got plenty of performance. The mild hybrid, works. You know, it does the whole auto stop start thing, but because it's a 48 volt system, the startups are a lot quicker, a lot smoother. The engine stays off longer at intersections. I mean, when you have a car that's just a 12 volt system with an auto stop start, a lot of times during the span of when you're sitting at a red light, you know, especially if it's warmer and you got the AC on or heat on, the engine's going to fire back up before the light turns green. And when you've got your foot on the brake pedal, that's when you really feel it start up. If you've managed to get all the way through the light cycle before it starts up, you lift your foot off the brake pedal, you generally don't feel it on most modern cars. But when your foot's on the pedal, you know, then you've got that reaction force working against the engine. That's when you hear it shake. So the mild, a 48-volt mild hybrid system, it stays off longer. You know, it you basically never feel the engine coming back on. You'll just, you might hear it a little bit, but you're not going to feel it. You know, the design of of the current generation Discovery is definitely different, you know, from all of the previous. This is the sixth generation Discovery. You know, it doesn't have that boxy look of the classic Discoveries. You know, so it's a very different look. You know, it looks fine, you know, but it's not, it doesn't really have the classic Land Rover look to it. And this is something that, you know, a lot of fans of the Discovery haven't really cared for all that much. You know, I'm fine with the design. I like the Sedona red paint that was on this one, especially before it got all dirty when I took it down some dirt roads when it was raining. Then it, you know, looked more like what a, you know, what you would expect a Land Rover to look like. The interior of the Discovery, of the current generation Discovery, something I was less enthused about. You know, it's mostly touch controls. The infotainment system is okay. It's a little slow.
Is it slow? Or this is my thing with the JLR infotainment system, is you touch it and then it sort of like fades to the next thing.
Yeah.
And so you're never like, is this slow or a feature?
Well, that's the thing. I think they do that. They do those slow animations to kind of hide the fact that it's actually kind of slow.
That it has latency?
Yeah. Yeah, and then, you know, you've got the, you do have a couple of big knobs for the temperature controls. Got a wireless charging pad. There is a knob on the center console for to choose the drive modes. It does have a 2-speed transfer case, so there is a 4-wheel drive low in addition to 4 high and all-wheel drive and 2-wheel drive. With the tires, you know, the all-season tires that were on this one, you know, it's not necessarily going to have the traction that you would want for a true off-roader. If you were to replace those tires with some proper all-terrain tires on smaller wheels, get rid of the 22-inch wheels, you know, go to, you know, something like an 18 with all-terrain tires on there, it's actually got some serious off-road capability. But the reality is that the people, usually, especially the people who buy these new, they don't take them off-road.
No,
they
don't never care. Going
there. It's usually like the third or fourth owner who will take one of these.
They'll park in a gravel parking lot at a like high-end farmer's market. Like where there's like the cheeses are all from goats.
Yeah.
And everything has the word heirloom in front of it.
Yeah. Kind of like the farmer's market in Bodega Bay.
Yeah, like artisanal.
Yeah,
everything. Yeah, the artisanal farmer's market.
Exactly.
Here's a tomato for $12.
Yeah.
Ooh.
I was surprised to learn that this is actually a 7-seater. Because when I, the rear seats. This one, yeah, you know, has electric fold third row seats. You know, when I opened up the cargo area, you know, there was a big rubber mat in there. Covering the whole cargo area, which was nice, because went to the lake, you know, got some sand in there, you know, wasn't, you know, easy enough to take out the rubber mat and shake it off. And then when I looked over on the side, I saw the switches. In order to put up the third row seats, you have to take out the rubber mat, leave that at home. You'll also have to take out the cargo cover. So there's a cargo cover that you can pull out. So you have to take that out because otherwise the third row seats can't go up all the way. And then there's some switches in the back on the left-hand side of the cargo area that you can use to lift up the third row seats. And I put them up, and there's actually a decent amount of legroom back there.
Good job.
They're actually usable. You don't have a whole lot of cargo space left behind the third row seat. I think most people will probably just use this as a 5-seater, you know, as a 2-row.
Like y'all met at the farmer's market, and now you're going to the very fancy like wine bar down the street.
Yeah.
Let's all get into discoveries.
Yeah.
Head on down to the wine bar, get a little boozed up, and then we'll come back and I'll drop you all off and you can get your individual cars and drive home.
There you go. Yeah. Do some wine tasting. Have some cheese. Have some more artisanal cheese. Some charcuterie. And then you can go home. So the Discovery, since it's a Land Rover, not inexpensive. Starts at $70,800 for the Gemini edition,
Gemini.
Which I actually was not even able to find on the Land Rover USA website.
Yeah, I looked it up. I couldn't find it.
Yeah, so I think they might have actually already switched over to 2027 models on the website, so they don't have the Gemini edition anymore.
Oh. Well, I'm glad they sent it to you.
The closest one they had was the Landmark, which also starts at $70,800. So I think they just rebranded it. You know, they don't actually have the model years on the Land Rover website, so not entirely sure. But you know, you got a multi-zone climate control system. This one had the advanced off-road capability pack for $2,400. That gets you the 2-speed transfer case. The all-terrain progress control, which is, you know, their fancy off-road traction control system. Also had the 22-inch wheels for $1,650. Again, if you're going to spend $2,400 on the off-road pack, don't spend $2,200 on 22-inch wheels.
Yeah, you kind
just
of...
Just saying. It does have a 20...
Like, I put the turbo on my car.
Yeah.
But then I put winter tires on it for the summer. You're like, what?
it does have it all. This one also had a 22-inch full size spare tire, which is nice treat to have. It had the cold climate pack, so that when you look through the windshield, if you look real carefully, you'll see the little zigzag wires running up all the way through the windshield to defrost it, which is, you know, those things that system works really well when it's, you know, when you're driving in the snow and ice. A few other things. Grand total, $83,195.
How much is a Defender?
Defenders, I think, start about $60,000 now.
Yeah, see. So here's it. I think I know people who have Land Rovers. And I think I know someone who has a Discovery, and when their LR, I think it was 3 or 4, was aging out, they were like, what should I get? And I told them a couple of things, and they got a Land Rover. They were going to get a Land Rover no matter what, so they just got the Discovery. I think that's they're it's a bit like Subaru people and Jaguar people. They're just, I'm just going to get it. They're not going to listen to, like, you know, well, Land Rover has a little ish, you know. Doesn't matter. We love their Land Rovers. Jaguar people, they love their Jaguars. Don't listen. If you went into the relationship understanding what the limitations were and what was going to happen. And if you're happy with that, if you're happy with your Land Rover, more power to you. You have a second car? Awesome.
Even better. Yeah.
Get the Civic Hybrid.
Yeah.
A Civic Hybrid and the Land Rover Discovery is perfect 2-car garage if you're a fan of Land Rover, but really you should have gotten the Defender.
Well, the Discovery is rated at 17 city, 23 highway, 19 combined. I did my like 45, 50 mile test loop that I do with most vehicles, and it's a combination of highway and city and suburban and rural driving. And it averaged 22 miles per gallon. So, it actually didn't do terribly.
Pretty good.
For a 3-row SUV, that is fairly hefty, that's competitive. Let's just say it's not embarrassing.
Yes. I got a Land Rover. The Defender 90, which is the one you should get, but no one's going to get that because it's only a 2-door. How much does this thing start at? Oh, if I got to scroll, I'm already angry. This is one of those things where I have to click on build your own before they tell me. Just look at this. I'm just wasting time now on the podcast.
Shop now. Let's see. Build and reserve Defender.
Oh my gosh. scroll down.
So Defender 90 starts at $61,000.
All right. There you go. That's pretty nice.
The 110 starts at 65, so that's the four-door.
Oh, yeah, there you go. So if you're weird like me and you want a two-door, you know, you'll save a little bit of cash.
Yeah.
Just get the Steelies, you know, boom.
Yeah.
Get a
set of Steelies with some Bridgestone KO3s, and you can go just about anywhere.
Boom. You get the 18-inch Steelies, the white wheels.
Yeah. Or you could go with the Defender Octa, which has the BMW twin-turbo V8 in it.
Oh, it does have the BMW. That's the best part of it.
And that, you know, that one's only $158,000.
Never mind. I mean, there's a reason why people use BMW engines, though. I mean,
yeah.
Just ask for a deer.
Let's carry on. So remember back in late 2024, it was all news that Honda and Nissan were going to merge.
Oh, yeah.
And they started having a bunch of discussions. And when Honda started looking at Nissan's books, I said, yeah, I don't think so. I think we can do this on our own. And then, you know, things started turning south for Honda last year as the whole EV thing started blowing up in their face, and they ended up canceling most of their EV projects.
In America, they're very quick to say, hey, we have joint ventures in China. We're still doing EVs in Europe. It's America.
Yeah.
I think at the end of the day, like, we don't want to deal with America.
Exactly.
Which I'm like, all right, fine, I guess. That SUV looked really nice, but fine.
Yeah. So, so they wrote off, I don't know, like $12, $15 billion or something like that.
Gazillion dollars, yeah.
Yeah. But part of that EV project was an all-new electrical architecture and a new software platform. So they had a zonal EE architecture for their EVs, and they had a new software platform. We don't know if that's actually going to be used going forward, but Nissan and Honda a few days ago announced that they have signed a joint development agreement for next generation software-defined vehicles, the new EE architecture, and a software platform that they're going to work on together. I reached out to both Nissan and to Honda, and they both said, we're not saying anything right now about what we're doing, about which software, which electronics we're going to use, but they're going to have common electronics, common ECUs between the two companies. My guess is it's probably going to be based on the stuff from the Zero Series.
Yeah.
With the Osimo OS. The first products using that are going to be coming out in fiscal year 2029, which is the Japanese all start their fiscal year on April 1st. And I'm trying to remember.
What year it is now? I think it's 2026.
It was 20.
So 3 years from now.
It might be two. Japanese fiscal year 2029. Starting April 29. Okay. So yeah, it won't be till 2029.
All right.
Starting in 2029, we'll start seeing products from Nissan and Honda that use this new common software platform and electronic architecture.
So it'll be interesting. I'm very interested to see what Honda does to return to the U.S. with EVs, because I've talked to them and it's I think there's something there. They're going to keep doing EVs elsewhere. Mm-hmm. I'm curious, but I know they're still working on their solid state battery.
Yeah.
They're still working on that. Nissan has its own process for doing solid. They're completely different. They're just bonkers different. How both of them are doing solid state batteries. I wonder, and this is wild off the top in the back of my head. This will probably never happen. If Honda is waiting until it figures out solid state to come back to the U.S. and just be like, look what we did. Look at that. Because it can continue to do all of its development for EVs for other countries, which it sells vehicles all over the world and other things. I saw two Moto Compactos at the race this weekend, by the way. people were just riding them around like a man and his son, or a man and a random child he found. Either way.
He had an extra Moto Compacto and said, "Hey, kid, want to come for a ride?"
A man and a happy child. because, you know, SDVs, typically those are EVs. They talk about carbon neutrality in here. Nissan's still working toward, you know, working with their EVs. They have the Leaf. They have Sakura, which, you know, is doing well in Japan for them. So, you know, they are a little bit more working towards EVs just because, and it helps that they have, like, you know, the lineage of the Leaf for X amount decades.
And they still sell the Aria in Japan and in other markets. They only discontinued it in North America.
Yeah. So I think it's Honda's extremely conservative company. They're super smart. Their engineering's insane. Their quality's great, but they're also very safe. Anytime there's something weird comes out of Honda, you should lose your mind because it took a long time for that to get, like, the Prelude, the Honda E, the brass did not want that vehicle to get sold. They did not like that vehicle at all. And the project lead, like, there was an interview with a Gadget where he was just like, "It's hard to build a car when you know your bosses hate it." And the reason that car didn't come to the U.S. is because of one person. And that's all I can say about that. But any sort of weird, fun things that come out of Honda, there's a lot of like, let me think.
Makes you wonder how they managed to get the Moto Compacto built.
Yeah, I really think it's just like, well, let's look at the numbers, let's figure it out, and then maybe every once in a while there's like a day. You know how they have those movies, The Purge, where once a year you can break all the laws or whatever. I think they have that sort of situation at Honda, where once a year everyone pitches the most insane ideas, and Honda has to do one of them. They have to allow one, and I think that's what happens. They have some sort of like idea purge.
I said, the Moto Compacto, not going to cost us very much. Okay, fine. Do it. Do that.
It'll be fun and goofy. We're not going to sell that many, but it'll be a fun, goofy thing. Come on.
Okay, fair enough.
We got generators. We make planes. We can make a little scooter.
They're making rockets now.
They're making rockets. Oh, yeah. They're making rockets.
Well, you know, and last fall at the Japan Mobility Show, one of the things that they unveiled was the Zero Alpha, which looks, you know, has the same kind of styling as the Zero SUV that they were going to build for North America, except it was a little bit smaller. You know, it was about like, you know, 7/8 scale version of the Zero Alpha or the Zero SUV. But it also used cheaper technology than what was supposed to go into the North American Zero Series cars.
Yeah.
And the Zero Alpha was meant for markets like India. So I wonder if we might see them bring that to North America at some point in the future.
I'm sure they're looking at Slate. They're looking at the Bolt, because the Bolt was selling really well before it got taken off the market. Uh-huh. I think they're looking, and they're seeing that people are like, you know what? And they're looking at the you know, the inexpensive truck, you know, because Slate, now everyone's coming out with an inexpensive pickup because the Maverick and Slate, let's just say those two vehicles, one's gas. And so, you know, you have Toyota. Toyota's supposed to be coming out with something. You know, I guess Dodge isn't doing Rampage. They're doing something else. Anyway. I think they're keeping an eye on the inexpensive EV market. And I think I continue to say this, that I think one of the problems was that everyone thought that an EV needed to be a space car with a billion screens and all this other stuff. And the reality is people just want a car.
Yeah.
It doesn't need to be designed, you know, the interior doesn't need to be like a spaceship. It doesn't need to be Star Trek themed. If it was Star Trek themed, it would sell really well, but it doesn't, it can just be a car. You could just make a Honda Civic that was an EV and people would be like, "Oh, yeah, that's fine. I'll buy it." Because I know people who, you know, the Prologue was just people who were like, "Oh, it's got a Honda badge on it. Now I'm going to buy an EV."
Yeah.
So I think they
and, you know, maybe they'll, you know, keep an eye on, you know, the Fathom is another one.
Yeah, the Fathom, I think, is going to be something they're going to really keep an eye on. Which is a great segue to some more news.
Yeah. So, you know, they've Ford dropped some more pictures of prototype Fathoms driving around, including some shots in Las Vegas. And Jim Farley said they want to build, they want to sell 100,000 Fathoms in the first year.
Isn't this how they got in trouble with the F-150 Lightning?
Well, you know, a lot's going to depend on, you know, whether, you know, they can actually keep the price down. Yeah. If they can do that, you know, if they can actually sell them, you know, for $30,000 to $35,000, yeah, then I think it could do well.
Oh, I think they can do well.
And they got to execute on the software. They can't screw up the software.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's where I feel like Slate has the advantage, because the software is like, well, we have a BMS. The end. We don't have to do anything else.
Yeah.
The BMS is done. What about this? No. We got an app and we can update it over the phone. And you don't even need the app to drive the car. Like, nope, you have to call back home. We're not doing it. We have a telematics kit for fleets, but, you know, we have the app. That's it. We don't have to deal with the software that doesn't start for 20 minutes while you're driving down the road.
If they can actually do that, if they can sell anywhere near 100,000 Fathoms in the first year, that would make it by far the best-selling EV in North America after Tesla, after the Model 3 and the Model Y. Because nothing has come close to that for any one nameplate.
I can get $30,000 for a Ford, which, you know, I think I said before, where Slate, you know, well, people are like, well, you should be able to get more for that $25,000. I'm like, first of all, they don't have the purchasing power or the scale or the ability to manufacture. They don't have the F-150, the big pile of money that comes in with the F-150 every year. They are a startup. This is the best you're going to get for $25,000 from a company like this. Whereas Ford, they could make this car $25,000 and still have it, you know, with more, better equipped than the Slate. But, you know, we want to do a little extra and we want to make some money. We have shareholders, which is something Slate doesn't have to deal with right now, that we have to deal with. So, yeah, if they could hit 30,000 and stick with it, don't pull a Maverick on us. Don't tell us, you know, later on, it's like, oh, yeah, well, now the starting price is 40% more. Just stick with it.
Yeah.
Everyone's going to buy them $35,000 one anyway, but stick with that number, because that news stays with you. That stays forever. That, again, that's the Silverado. Chevy had the opposite problem with the Silverado, because it came out and everyone's like, it's a $100,000 truck. And now forever in the general populace mind is this truck starts at $100,000. You can buy it for 60. Yeah. But that's not how regular people see that truck. I've had people come up to me, you know, this truck costs $100,000. And I'm like, okay, let me tell you a little story about bad marketing.
Yes. Yeah. GM made a big mistake, you know, launching just the work truck only for fleets and then the RST for $100,000, you know, and then bringing out cheaper models. But even the cheaper models are still not that cheap. You know, yeah, they start at like $60,000. But then again, that's the price of most trucks now.
Yeah, that's how much a truck costs anyway. So $60,000 is like, oh, all right. So if this is like half the price, it has, you know, room, you know, it has four doors, which people love. For me, my personal life, don't need four doors.
Yeah.
we have a car with four doors for the dogs.
Speaking of Ford, while we're with Ford, the Fox Body Mustangs.
Oh, you know, yeah.
I bought one in 1990 when I graduated from college. I bought a 5-liter LX. I paid $13,000 for it. 8 years later, with like 90,000 miles on it, I sold it for $5,000.
That's pretty good.
Can you imagine paying $280,000 for a Fox Body Mustang?
I cannot, because I felt like these things were everywhere. They were just, the world was silly with Fox Bodies. You could peel out of them. You could do a donuts in them, because they had the live axle, so that it, you know. It was
trust me, I know.
It just, yeah.
You could just look at that thing funny and it would spin.
Exactly. It was like the easiest car on the planet.
You hit a pedal mid corner, boom, the back end is hanging up.
Yeah. It wasn't a great cornering car.
It was not sophisticated, no.
No. But it was very fast.
Yeah.
And you know, my parents had friends who had a shop and they just fixed up Fox bodies. Like that's like their main thing was people bring in, they do engine work on them. They do body work on them. And it was just like the Fox. Like I went down there once because they had purchased something for me at cost. And it was just like Fox bodies, just as far as the eye could see. And the idea that this, how much is this thing again?
$279,000.
I don't like in the description that it says the world's first and only Ford Mustang Fox Body Resto Mod, because that cannot
no,
be
it's,
true.
No, it's by no means is this the first, not even close to the first Resto Mod Fox Body.
Yeah, that's not true.
So many
at
of
all.
These things were built. I mean, you know, the Fox Body Mustang was introduced in 1979 and was built until 1993.
It was just, yeah.
And they built a ton of these things.
There were cop cars.
Yeah. But, you know, this one is kind of interesting. They built a new frame that they bolt to the bottom of the body to stiffen it up, you know, because, okay. You know, the Fox bodies, although, you know, the notchback Fox bodies, which is what I had a notchback, mm-hmm. You know, were quite a bit stiffer than the hatchbacks. The hatchbacks, you know, they were a little flexible. And then the convertibles, well, that... there was no structural integrity at all to the convertible.
It was just like, woo!
The notchbacks were actually pretty good. But, you know, so this one, the first one they built, you know, they've got an extra frame bolted to the bottom of the body. They've got a modified Coyote V8 in this thing. Bigger brakes, you know, suspension's been all redone. The interior's been all redone. It's both modern, but it still looks like, you know, late 80s, early 90s.
It's a cool looking car.
Yeah.
I always liked the look of the Fox body. I just never wanted one because I drove through the mountains most of the time. And I was just like, this is a death trap.
Yeah.
In the mountains. This is not drive the way I want to drive.
Yeah.
But I always liked the look of the Fox body. I thought it was like a cool looking Mustang.
Yeah. Like I said, I had a notchback. 1991 5-liter LX, and I love that car. And you know, every once in a while I look online, you know, to see, you know, how much it would cost. I mean, even just a basic one now would cost like in decent shape would cost like $20,000, which is insane. I can't imagine that. I can't imagine that that car costing $20,000, you know, 40 years later.
Oh, no. That's the crazy. It's the Gen X. We all have a little bit more money. Yeah. Well, I mean, everyone who didn't become writers. Everyone else who's Gen X, we have a little less money as writers. But, you know, it's like I bought my 90 Honda Civic in 1991 for $5,000 from the school counselor.
Yeah.
And I got a really great deal on it. I sold it to a friend in the mid-2000s because he had hit hard times. He didn't have a car. Like he didn't have a job, and I sold it to him for $300 to be nice. That person ended up like, you know, being a jerk to me later on. Well, thanks a lot, buddy. Anyway, now if I'm looking for these, they're like $12,000 for a 90 Honda Civic hatchback. It's just like, nope, you want this? Yeah, well, you're going to have to pay through the nose. Every once in a while, I'll see just a regular person driving one. It's got a few little dents. It's a little rusted, but it's still going. And I always want to go out to him like, hey, I'll give you $1,200 for your car and see if they bite.
Well, this insanely expensive Mustang comes from a company in Florida called Velocity Restorations. And they, you know, they do all these resto mods, you know, and so they do... first generation Ford Broncos. They do F series, like going from the 67 F100 or F150, and then like the 67 to 70s, mid 70s F250s and 350s. They do the 67, 68 Mustang fastbacks and convertibles, and the Fox bodies, which are new. They do Chevy CK pickups, K5 Blazers, and also Scout 2s, 71 to 80 Scout 2s. So, you know, if you're, you know, if you've got a hankering for, you know, something that looks classic, but is insanely expensive and, you know, undoubtedly far better than the original.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And especially when you work on when they do the chassis work on any of these things, yeah. Because I don't think people realize how many cars were just like bonkers bad at cornering in the 80s and 90s. You're just like, whee!
The suspensions on the Broncos and the Scouts, you know, are way more sophisticated, you know, than what they had back in the 60s.
Yeah, they're just... It's just floating around as the car's going.
Check out Velocity Restorations if you've got some money to spend. What else? Scout. Speaking of Scout, they last week showed off the two more variations of the Traveler, their SUV. Because they got to do something before they eventually finally start building these things, maybe someday.
They're getting close to pulling a 90 Buzz. They need to put these things on the market.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's still a good year away from volume production.
I know. And again, this is a company that's it's a Volkswagen company.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, Slate shows up like a year and a half ago, and then they have the pre-production cars that people are riding in now. They're supposed to have production by the end of the year. Like, that doesn't, you know, I think there's a time where you have to, like, you know, wait before you tell everyone about your car. Because you end up with, you know, like I said, the ID Buzz issue where, like, everyone was excited about the Buzz, and then 7 years later, the Buzz came to market.
Yeah.
And you're just like, and everybody's like, whatever. Well, I think then the EV9 was out, and you're like, well, I can just get an EV9 for the same price. It's a vastly superior vehicle.
I think in Scout's case, you know, probably the biggest problem is they're trying to figure out how to make the EREV thing work and still maintain some towing capability with these things.
Yeah.
But the two concepts that they showed last week are the Mountainside, which is, you know, this is more, you know, for the Range Rover customer, you know, who's going to drive it up to, up to their cabin in Aspen, to go skiing, or, you know, drive it down Rodeo Drive, you know, but it's never actually going to really go off road. And then they have the, what they call this other one here, and they showed these off at the Jazz Aspen Snowmass Labor Day Experience last week.
It says Trail Ready Concept.
Yeah. Okay, so it doesn't actually have a name.
It doesn't have a, like, wait, what's the name? Is it Mountainside? Okay.
So the Trail Ready Concept, you know, it's got big all-terrain tires, you know, got some Goodrich, mud terrain TAs, roof rack, you know, all the goodies on there, from true off-roading, you know, 35-inch on 18-inch beadlock wheels. Yeah, so all the fun stuff. So
I like the way the Scouts look.
Yeah.
I think they're cool.
There's the trail-ready one.
I like that they are pro buttons in the car and knobs.
Yeah.
They're like, there's so much about them that I like. I understand, you know, EREV, sure, why not? You know, people are going to, you know, want EREVs. I like that, you know, if you can get
That's the Mountainside.
Yeah. But you gotta come to market, man.
Yeah. Eventually.
Got it. Entry model pricing expected to start under 60. Cool. Initial production targeted for 2027.
Yeah.
Doesn't say early, doesn't say middle, doesn't say late, just says 2027.
But you're not gonna get that EREV for 60 grand.
Oh no, you're definitely not gonna. You're gonna get something else. But yeah, if you can.
And then
gotta be careful. Someone else is gonna come in. I mean, Rivian, that's who's coming in. And
yeah,
you gotta.
I mean, they've been shipping R2s all summer. Yep. I've got one coming in a week and a half. So there are SUVs that actually are coming to market, and will probably be here almost certainly before the Scout, including the new Mitsubishi Pajero, which they unveiled last week in Asia, in Tokyo. This is going to be built at their factory in Thailand. It's a new body-on-frame SUV, looks pretty cool.
Looks very angry.
Yeah.
I don't know what I did to Mitsubishi, but I'm sorry.
Yeah, I mean, it's been a while since they built a Pajero, but it's back. And if it's anything like the old Pajeros, it'll have some serious off-road capabilities. The one they showed has a diesel engine. So if and when it comes to North America, it will definitely not have that engine in it, I don't think.
It looks very Hyundai coded.
Yeah. What do you think of this interior?
I'm looking at the close-ups of the. I mean, there are buttons. Some, it's those little rocker rollers, which I would rather have a knob, to be honest. I would like more buttons, but it's Mitsubishi, so we should just be happy that they're doing something. To be fair, Mitsubishi sells a lot of like other types of vehicles. They're not just like if just because they're not really here,
they sell a ton of vehicles in other markets.
Yeah,
they're not big in North America.
Fine, they're doing fine.
They're big
everywhere
in Asia.
Else. Yeah. Like the Outlander PHEV was like the number one PHEV in Europe for a while.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So this this is probably We may get the Pajero. They haven't confirmed it. We may get the Pajero, or they might call it a Montero for North America.
Yeah, they'll probably call it a Montero.
But they've got other products coming too. They said that they're going to have something new every year from now through 2030. They just launched the Eclipse Sportback, which is just a rebadged Leaf. But they've got a pickup truck based on the Nissan Frontier. They've got a couple more SUVs, including probably a version of this for North America, as well as one that's based on the new Nissan Xterra that's coming in 2028. So they're going to have a bunch of additional product in their lineup. So,
yeah, well,
that's good.
I mean, if they make it here, let me see what they got. What's some cool cars? What's some cool European cars that we could get from Mitsubishi? That might never come here, but maybe if they start doing well here. Nah,
I don't know.
That exciting. Never mind.
I'm not sure what they
ignore
sell.
Ignore me.
Yeah. I think they mostly are just selling SUVs and crossovers now and some vans, like K vans. Yeah. So we had some pictures recently of the new Hyundai Elantra. But there's an interesting detail about the Elantra, at least overseas. And for the entry-level versions of the Elantra, Hyundai is going to offer it without an instrument cluster. They'll have just the center screen.
How much could an instrument cluster cost? Come on.
I don't know.
This is ridiculous.
They're also doing this on the Ioniq 3, which we don't get.
Yeah. I mean, come on. Just how much is it? I bought like a 15-inch screen, just a digital screen for as a second display for an iPad, and it was like $50. I'm not buying my cost. I'm not buying like how much could some wiring and they got the molding. Just use the molding from another vehicle. Like, how much could that all cost? Especially if it's just the base layer, the base model.
Well, and, if you look at the way Hyundai and Kia build their vehicles, the display setups are usually common across a whole bunch of different models. Like you look at the Tucson, the Santa Cruz, the Santa Fe, they've got this big module that's got two 12.3-inch displays in it that they put on half a dozen different vehicles. And it's the same part.
boop, boop. It's a parts bin. Boop.
Yeah.
Like put a speedometer there, something.
Yeah.
But the idea that you have to like, I think that the University of Ohio maybe did some research where having your display to the right instead of in front of you actually was, you know, it takes you longer to look and see what's going on. I'll have to look it up. But God, come on.
So
even a little speedo, just a circle. Yeah. This is how fast you're going.
let's talk about charging a little bit. So recently here in Michigan, this guy rented a Chevy Bolt, and he was driving a friend to the airport, and on his way home, I'm starting to run a little low, decided he needed to stop and charge. No problem. Pulled out the EVgo app, looked for a public charging station nearby, found one in Macomb Township, which is northwest of Detroit, or northeast of Detroit, and pulled in there, and he made a mistake that we're going to warn you all not to do. Before you ever plug into a public charging station, find out how much they actually charge you, how much they're going to bill you for the electricity. Because this particular charger was a ChargePoint charger, and EVgo and ChargePoint have a roaming agreement. So EVgo chargers show up in the ChargePoint app. ChargePoint chargers show up in the EVgo app. They each have their own, backends to, handle billing and everything. And ChargePoint has kind of a unique business model for charging. So what they do is they build and sell the chargers to site hosts, and then they run the backend service, so they run the software and do all the billing and authentication and everything when you plug in. And the site hosts, they determine what to charge. So a lot of times you can go to like a grocery store or something, and there will be some ChargePoint chargers there. There's no charge. It's just a nice amenity they provide for customers. Washtenaw Community College nearby here, they have a half a dozen ChargePoint level 2 chargers in their parking garage. They're free to use. This particular charger that this gentleman used was at Elder Hyundai in Macomb Township. Elder Hyundai had this one marked as a public charger, but they did not actually want the public to use this charger. They wanted it to be for their staff, for charging their vehicles that they're dealing with, and for their customers, but not for members of the general public. But rather than just making it private, what they did was they set the rate for this charger. So when you use a public charger, Robbie, how much do you typically pay?
So it depends. It's about, let's say about 56 cents per kilowatt hour. That's about like the EA, EVgo. I know Ionis is cheaper. I know Tesla's more expensive. But like in the middle, let's just say 56 cents per kilowatt hour.
So this Hyundai dealer set the rate at $5 per kilowatt hour.
Oh my God.
And $5 per minute. So a session fee and charging fee. And this guy, unfortunate guy, plugged in the Bolt for 44 minutes to charge it up.
As you would.
Got a bill for $418 to charge the Bolt.
So with ChargePoint, so this happened to me, not like this, by the way, not this much. Is a library? It's something. I think it's like a, it's something. And they have 3 charge points in front of their building, and they're closed on the weekend. So I've gone there and used the charger I went there and used it for a video. I'm like, no one's around. I need something I can plug in and unplug to show the video. Well, the way they have it set up is when you plug in, there is a $15 charge just to plug in. And then they charge the usual per kilowatt hour. So mm-hmm. I don't ever go there because I paid $18 for like 5 minutes charge. and what they do is that this is like at SAE headquarters, we have EA, we have a ChargePoint chargers, but they're for the staff. Right. You know, they're private, and you have
And a lot of businesses use ChargePoint chargers, you know, for workplace charging, things like that.
So your account is associated, like the person who runs those chargers in the building, like, what's your account? And you tell them, and then they unlock it for you. So these businesses like this, they unlock it for, you know, individual accounts. So if he had, so I'm sure all the people who work at this dealership are using the same, you know, Hyundai dealership account, where it doesn't cost them anything, but anyone else who plugs in gets hosed.
Yeah, because the ChargePoint chargers all have RFID readers, and you can get RFID cards and tags. You know, so they probably have, you know, all the staff probably have an RFID tag for these chargers.
Yeah,
you so just it doesn't charge them anything.
So that that's the ChargePoint. I'm always a little, because of that $18 charge. Every time you come up to a ChargePoint, I'm always like, okay, what's the, how much does it cost to plug in? Like, you got to, like, really,
you know,
so
fortunately,
most of the time, because of that, I don't use ChargePoint.
Yeah. Well, fortunately, you know, in the ChargePoint app, it'll show you what the rates are, and also on the display. It'll tell you on the display.
Yeah,
most chargers will, you know, whatever network you're using, except for Tesla, because they have no displays. So you just have, you have to look in the app to see how much it's going to be. But for others, it's typically, shown on the display. Here's what the rate is going to be, you know, for your normal rate. And here's what it is if you have, like, you know, the subscription, you pay like $7 or $10 a month or whatever, and you get discounted rates. So fortunately, for this gentleman, he called up one of the local TV stations in Detroit, and, you know, they did a report on this, and he also contacted EVgo, you know, because they were EVgo, even though they don't own this charger, they guided him towards this charger, and so they gave him a goodwill refund of all but $13 and change, you know, which would have been
the regular, what it would have cost
rate for charging that car.
Yeah. That's good. And that's the thing is that, like, I have an EVgo charger mounted to the fence of my house. So I like EVgo stuff.
Yeah.
And I lied. I do use an EVgo charger. There's one in Tehachapi at the Denny's and it charges like 60 something kilowatts. So it's perfect for going in and, like, cause I always hang out with one of my friends at the Denny's in Tehachapi when I go and visit, cause the only thing that's open late, and I can charge whatever car. Usually it's either my car or some sort of EV that I'm testing, and I can plug it in and it'll charge for like an hour or two while I eat my dinner. So it's a nice little, like, oh, I like this because it's not charging at 350 kilowatts and now I got to move my car. It's like, hey, you want to just charge here while you eat? Cool. I mean, it's, but it has the pricing, and the pricing is just regular pricing.
Yeah. So, yeah, bottom line, before you plug into a public charger, make sure you check the prices, and if it's not listed, then, you know, find another charger. And, yeah, I looked.
App.
I looked on the alternative fuels data center map. And this charger has since this happened, this charger has been marked as private, so it's no longer listed as public. And there was a couple of other DC fast chargers like within 2 miles of this one. So unless you're like, you know, stone cold dead, you know,
I feel bad because this person was probably like, you know what? I don't need to charge at 350 because I have a Chevy Bolt. This one's only 200, but I don't like go here. So they're trying to be a good person.
Yeah.
And they got hosed, and the money doesn't go to EVgo. Like,
right,
you know, they get some money.
It was just a
I'm sorry, the money doesn't go to ChargePoint. It goes to the dealership.
Yeah,
they're
the
ones getting the $400 and something.
Yeah, I mean, ChargePoint gets a percentage of that, but yeah, most of it goes to the dealer.
Yeah.
On the flip side of that, Norway. Norway, which has been leading the world in adoption of EVs, you know, it's like something like almost 99% of new vehicle sales in Norway are electric now.
Yeah.
Norway also has amazing charging infrastructure. And most of it is not DC fast charging. Statistics Norway published some data, that the city of Oslo, the capital, now has 4,519 public charging points just within one city. And of those, 78% of those were rated between, they're level two chargers. They're rated between 3.6 and 43 kilowatts. And then another 611 were rated between 50 and 250 kilowatts, and 376 were rated above 300 kilowatts. So this, you know, they have curbside charging everywhere in Oslo. And, you know, it's the way it should be. You know, wherever there's places to park, they should have these posts, you know, and the way they do it there is the cable is not permanently connected to the charging post. You know, you just have electricity running to the charging post. You bring your own cable in the car. There's a standard connector on there. You plug it into your car. When you're done, you unplug, throw the cable back in your trunk. And, you know, next time you park somewhere, you plug it in there.
It's amazing to bring your own cable. I've done it in Germany. And so, like, you know, the one of the issues with cables, like, just hanging there is that people have been stealing them. Mm-hmm. And also, if it's like on a public walkway, now you just got a cable.
Yeah.
That's, you know, someone doesn't put it up, someone knocks it over, someone vandalizes it. Now it's in the walkway.
Or if it falls on the roadway, somebody drives over it.
Yeah. So the bring your own cable model, I do not understand why the United States is not, like, no one. Everyone's like, oh, we're going to put cables on a giant thing that lowers it down. It's like we're over engineering a very simple problem.
Yeah.
Which is just bring your own cable. That's it. I've used it in Germany. Whenever I go, I've been to Norway, and I'm like, this is amazing. This is why. It's because they're just, if you look at them, they're just boxes.
Yeah.
It's just, here's a box. It's just like a bollard. Bunk.
With a
and
plug.
Everyone has the cable in their car. It comes with your car.
Well, in some cars, like I think it's the Fiat Panda, it has the cable in the front. And
oh, it's got
actually
the...
it's coiled like, you know, like
it's like
the
an old
hose.
Vacuum cleaner.
Yeah. You know, so it's coiled up, you know, and you just open the flap, you pull the cable out, plug it into the post, you're good to go.
No, it's like bring your own cable is super smart. It's super easy because at that point you're not going to cut into this cable to steal it because there's electricity going through it.
Yeah.
So the bring your own cable, it's been years of me complaining about it, and I will continue to shout it from the rooftops. Bring your own cable is the right way to do AC charging.
And there are a few companies here in the US, like It's Electric, that are doing this now, and they've got deployments in several cities now, including in Detroit, and where they have they're set up, you know, they have a post, and so they work with building owners, and so all they got to do is run like a small little narrow trench through the sidewalk to run a power line into the building, and it runs out to the post. You can go to the It's Electric website. You can get a cable from them, keep it in your car. You know, if you live somewhere where there's It's Electric chargers, and you have an account, when you plug in, it charges your account. The money from that is split between the building owner and It's Electric.
I think I have a video where I use bring your own cable, but I don't know if it's about bring your own cable. So I'm going to look it up, because if it is, then you can see just how ridiculous and easy it is. And it makes me so angry that we don't.
All right. Do you remember the Chevy Beretta?
I do remember the Beretta.
I remember the Beretta because I was still an engineering co-op student. I was going to GMI. I was working at GM Canada when the Beretta came out. And, at the plant that I worked at in St. Catharines, we built the engines, the V6 engines that they used in the Berettas. So it had like the same 2.8 liter V6 or an updated version of the 2.8 liter V6 that originally came out in the Citation in like 1980. By that time we were doing fuel injected versions, and there were later, you know, different variations of it, a 3.1 and a 3.5 liter. Well, Chevy wanted to do a more powerful version of the Beretta in the late 80s, early 90s, because like Ford, they thought, you know, we need to move away from the big V8 powered Camaros, you know, just like Ford was saying about, yeah, we need to have something more, a more fuel efficient replacement for the Mustang. And Ford, you know, saw the error of their ways and decided, yeah, this Mazda-based vehicle that we were going to sell as a new front-wheel drive Mustang, that's going to be the Ford Probe. So that became the Probe, and they kept building rear-wheel drive Mustangs up until this day. You know, GM had their own idea about this, and they took a Beretta and built a prototype, and they decided to put a V8 in it. And, you know, at that time, GM still owned a big stake in Isuzu, and Isuzu had a little 3.2-liter V8 engine, or 3.5-liter V8 engine, that they dropped it in there. They put it into this Beretta, and they called it the Ferretta. Not sure exactly why, but you can see, you know, if you're watching the video, lots of vents in the hood to cool this thing, had this little V8 mounted transversely in the Beretta. I can just imagine the torque steer from this car.
So every time you put your foot on the accelerator, it's just like, whoa. Like, hold on tight. It was one of those hold on tight cars.
Oh yeah, very much so. So they, you know, they obviously never put this into production, but they did keep the prototype around in the GM Heritage Center for a number of years, until 2009, when GM was going through its bankruptcy. And, you know, in order to raise some cash, they sold off a bunch of the cars from the Heritage Center. And this was one of them. So the Ferretta, as GM called it, is in the hands of private owners. So it's out there somewhere. I think it's currently owned by some guy in Florida. You know, it's never really been modified, you know, or restored, because there's no parts for it.
No, yeah,
you can't get any parts for this engine because it was never put into production.
I'm gonna find this video.
So that's the V8 Ferretta. The Ferretta.
It's very weird when you're like, "Yeah, we got to make some money. Let's sell off of these cars." I really don't feel like those cars make enough money to make even a dent in like any issues that they're having. It's probably more like we need to free up. Let's get rid of this building.
Yeah.
So we have to sell these cars because we don't have anywhere to put these vehicles.
Free up some space.
Like, yeah. Let's get rid of those.
And then finally, last week, Secretary of Energy Sean Duffy had a speech, because the Trump administration is finalizing its new corporate average fuel economy regulations and basically rolling it back from what was going to be what was targeted. You know, under the Biden administration, they were targeting 50.4 miles per gallon fleet average by 2031,
which is a long way.
Yeah, and they're rolling it back to 34.5 miles per gallon. But you know, Duffy was claiming that, you know, this is going to reduce the price of new cars by $930.
What?
No.
How?
It's AI math.
I don't think he knows how car manufacturing works.
No. Well, the thing is, you know, okay, even if they, you know, were able to get rid of some stuff, you know, and, you know, that make the cars less fuel efficient and make them cheaper, it's actually still going to cost you more to buy that slightly cheaper car. Yeah, you know, and that's assuming that any manufacturer actually reduced the price of the car, which they won't. I wrote an article for the Telemetry blog about this. That the claims of savings are a lie. Because what would end up happening is if they did reduce the average, and the thing to keep in mind about the corporate average fuel economy numbers, these are based on the original two cycle tests, the original city and highway drive cycles, unadjusted numbers. So these are the tests that they came up with back in the 1970s. And they still have those tests, but these are not the numbers that the car can actually do or that goes on the window sticker. So the 50 miles per gallon actually comes out to, I think it was about 30 some. It's about 34 or 36 miles per gallon, roughly. So if your car was getting 50 miles per gallon, according to CAFE, it would actually be somewhere in the mid 30s.
Yeah, on the sticker. So when you go and you look at the car, it says it gets 36 miles per gallon. You're like, oh, cool. That's a good.
And there's lots of cars out there that do that today.
Like I just drove a Prelude. I was getting like 42 or something. Yeah.
So, based on, 4 miles per gallon or $4 per gallon gas, which, is way cheaper than you can actually get in California. The current national average is $4.10 a gallon. You would be paying about $650 a year more for gas. So even if you saved $930, after 18 months, less than 18 months, you would already be paying more, and you would continue paying more and more and more for as long as you drove that car.
I don't really understand. Like, it's like, hey, everybody, stop working on what you're doing. But at the end of the day, everyone's still like, well, we're going to keep putting hybrids and things because people like saving money on gas.
Yeah.
That's the other thing. Clearly the market has spoken. The market wants better gas mileage. Even if you never want to drive an EV, you probably want to drive a hybrid.
Yeah.
I mean, there are people who are like, I will never drive a hybrid because I don't know why. But really, the average person just, they want their car and they would like it to get better gas mileage because gas is expensive. And even when gas isn't really expensive, when it's just sort of expensive, they still would like to save money.
Yeah. And the price premium for hybrids now, has shrunk so much. It's typically, in a lot of cases, it's less than $2,000.
Yeah, it's nearly parity. It's like EV, like EV versus gas is nearly parity as well. We're getting to a point where it's like, well, there's so much money. I'm like, not really. The amount of money you're going to save over the lifetime of your vehicle is way more than what you're going to like save buying your vehicle. So, yeah, I still don't understand. Where do you get this number of
They made it up. They do everything.
Yeah. I don't know. I get Department of Energy press releases like 3 times a day, and every time I'm just like, what are we doing? So I found a video about me and curbside parking. I never edited it together because I had another Porsche video that was due at the same time, and it was with a Porsche. So maybe I'll edit that together sometime over the next week or two before I start traveling again. Here's a video of me just plugging a car in Germany with the bring your own cable. And it was a Porsche, a purple Porsche. So it looks
perfect.
Cool.
Was that when you drove the Taycan Cross Turismo?
When I was driving around Germany. And I talked to the head of Powertrain, who told me about how they made it better and stuff. And a really nice guy.
Cool.
Smart guy, too.
All right. Well, I think that's all we've got for this week. We'll talk to you all next time. Bye.
Bye. Doot.